This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Everything you read in the mainstream media is 100% true. Please, go back to your jobs. If you have not got a job, you are a worthless human being. Consume, consume, consume until we have no planet left to consume. What you need to do is buy things that you don't need. That's the best way to support the economy.
Until you realize major, confused by the same rage that it takes the size of the cage that they put you in it. Taste the truth is addictive and being black so repressive that finding what lurks in the dark side. Religious ties are
collapse is the new thing. Columnists in collapsing newspapers write about it. Historians tell us it's coming. Prominent economists predict it. We all expect it. What is collapse? Definitions vary from uncontrollable downturns all the way to great culls in our population. Let's start gently with mild-mannered Professor Dennis Meadows, one of the original authors to The Limits to Growth. Here is a clip from a film prepared September 2009 for leaders and billionaires at Davos, Switzerland.
Technically speaking, collapse is a process where things go down out of control. So if, for example, a building collapses, it falls down not under the control of anybody. Societal collapse is for the key indicators of our society: material standard of living, peace, trust in the government, and other things, to fall without control. The situation is, for us, is kind of like living in a city which has earthquakes, let's say Tokyo or San Francisco. I can tell my friend in San Francisco that with 100% probability, there's going to be another really big earthquake in San Francisco. Absolutely. No uncertainty about it. But when? That's the question. And how big? These are important questions. We don't have any scientific way of understanding. Could be tomorrow, could be 30 years from now. Same thing with collapse. I know that the current growth in population and material use absolutely cannot continue. 100% probability it's going to stop. When? How? How seriously? We have no scientific way to make predictions.
Fine. It's like a building in Chile if you expect and prepare for collapse, or a concrete pancake in Haiti if you don't. I'm Alex Smith. In this program, we'll hear two of the most prominent voices. Dumb media calls them collapsniks. I have much more respect. Dmitry Orlov keeps piercing the veil with his insights, gained partly from his Bridging the Gap Between the Former Soviet Union and the Increasingly Dysfunctional United States. Then John Michael Greer has moved from the edge of mysticism into a thought leader for alternative culture. You won't find either one on your father's radio station. This is Radio EcoShock. The possibility of collapse has finally escaped into the mainstream news. Our guest, Dmitry Orlov, predicted such extreme difficulties years ago. He added tips to soften our landing based on his experiences in the sudden fall of the Soviet Union. Dmitry, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Well, it's good to have you too. And I notice that now the business press and economists and even scientists openly talk about collapse. But what does that really mean?
Well, it basically means that the living arrangement that people have been counting on to last for their lifetimes, the lifetimes of their children and their grandchildren, is unraveling at a rate that people can no longer ignore. And it's an upsetting thing to watch. And the fact that nobody can come up with a viable alternative that can be sold is really distressing to a lot of people at all levels, not just you know, regular people, but the elites that are supposedly in control.
Things seem paranormal. I can still go shopping in the mall. A relative is thinking of buying a new car. What makes you think a widespread collapse is coming?
Well, in terms of looking at it, there's an interesting effect. For instance, if you have a house and the foundation is falling apart, it's cracking, and there are termites in the posts and the rafters are rotted, and there's rain coming through the roof and there's a tree poking through the roof, then a building inspector can come around and condemn it. Now, you can't really do that to, you know, an industrial and military superpower. That's like walking up to a rhinoceros and telling it to roll over. It won't listen to you. And unless we see some really amazing signal events, a political unraveling, for instance, or such a severe economic crash that the economy, as we're used to thinking about it, simply evaporates, we won't really be able to say, aha, well, here's collapse. And once collapse occurs, nobody will be thinking of it in terms of anything systemic because everything will be reduced to the level of the neighborhood or the family or the village, and people will be too busy basically scraping things together in order to survive for another day to think about big issues like where is the country going.
And is this limited to just America?
I think in other parts of the world, people are much more aware. For instance, American expats around the world, and I've been in touch with quite a few of them, have really very little trouble grasping the concept of the United States collapsing. A lot of them see it as inevitable. A lot of them are actually spending time living in other countries because they don't think that this country is such a good bet anymore. And they basically have a much easier time, a much better perspective on things. Whereas if you are living inside the United States and you depend on mass media, American mass media, to get all of your information, then you're basically buying into a fictional version of reality that doesn't correspond to what's going on either in this country or the rest of the world.
You know, every now and then I find a quote I think worth chiseling in stone, and here's one from your blog. I'm just going to read it quickly. This, then, should be the main thrust of industrial activity, to manufacture and distribute products with the understanding that this process will run out of resources and stop. These products must be designed to outlive the process by which they are made by as long as possible. Tell us about this article and why you wrote it.
Well, people sometimes think that I'm some sort of Cassandra, that I actually prognosticate because I'm one of the people who likes to do that sort of thing. And that's actually pretty far from reality because I'm just an engineer in search of meaningful employment, which turns out to be an almost impossible proposition. Because as an engineer, you work in an economy that makes throwaway items. The average useful life of a manufactured item these days is less than a year. We're just making garbage. And so what I want to do is move on from that to make things that are basically technical heirlooms that we can use for the rest of our lifetimes and pass it on to our children and their grandchildren, things that people working with hand tools and replacing parts with hand-fashioned parts can maintain perpetually, that don't really have any kind of obsolescence built into them. Now, you might think that this is impossible because everything we own, you know, it breaks and we throw it away. It turns out that that's not really the case. As an engineering, as a technological problem, it is not an unsolvable problem. It just requires a completely different mindset.
And those are the sort of products we're going to need if we even dream of having a civilization that might last for hundreds or even 1,000 years, wouldn't you say?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, for instance, there are bridges in Rome that have trucks going over them every day that were built by the Romans. They were assembled in such a way that basically there's no deterioration over time. The mortar and the quality of the cut stone was such that it'll probably last for millennia. There are lots of things like that that can be built. There are a lot of systems that can be put together having to do with things like water supply, for instance, that can be put together in ways that will not deteriorate rapidly, do not require machinery for maintenance, and will persist. And then just about everything else we have won't really last longer than a decade.
I want to talk about another big bubble. Lots of young people are hiding out almost in universities and colleges. They're building up big student debts and hoping the job market will be better when they get out. A recent news article reports 60% of American student loans are 3 months in arrears or in outright default. has higher education become another big Ponzi scheme?
I think it's beyond Ponzi scheme. I think that if you wanted to engineer a revolution, this is how you would go about it. You would take a whole bunch of highly educated young people, and you deprive them of anything meaningful to do while saddling them with unrepayable debts. If you really wanted to foment rebellion, this is the exact way to go about it, because in a few years of hanging out in their parents' basements while their loans compound, you know, into hundreds of thousands of dollars, they won't be so eager to find employment or even look for employment. They will be eager to go out and hurt whoever stole their future.
Wow. Well, on another front, I've just been arguing about capturing carbon and storing it underground. My general operating theory is this: we cannot leave storage problems for future generations because no civilization has lasted more than a few hundred years. So things like CO2 and nuclear waste have to be monitored and handled maybe for thousands of years. Doesn't your idea of collapse determine the types of technology we can use now?
Yes, it does. There are lots of things that can be done on a very local level, leaving aside, you know, really big engineering problems like nuclear waste, for instance, or carbon sequestration, which is, you know, I don't know how much of it will actually occur, but it can. Certain things can be done on very local and limited bases. For instance, we can't really afford to flush human waste downstream somewhere and basically have it ferment so that it off-gasses and all of the nutrients in it are lost. So all of human waste will have to be composted and returned to the soil. Add to that the fact that most of the sewage systems are unmaintainable. People won't be able to continue having sewage treatment. So the choice is really between soil depletion to a point where we can't really grow enough food, coupled with contamination so that everybody has hepatitis A at least, and cholera epidemics and things like that, that or putting things together so that human waste is composted and returned to the soil. That's just one example. Another one is, you know, there's a lot of wood and pulp and other organic materials that can be turned to charcoal and buried in the soil. And that has really good ways. Not only does it sequester carbon, but it also builds soil. And the moisture content of the soil goes up, so you can turn very sandy soil into something that can be productive. So those are the things that can be done on a very local level. Another example is you can compensate for lack of irrigation by building swales, which are basically very narrow ditches that run at a certain level along a hillside. And what they create is a freshwater lens under the surface of the ground, and they also can collect rainwater for other uses when there are heavy rains. So this is a way to compensate for lack of pumping abilities for irrigation water so that the entire system is passive and gravity-driven. But to build this, you need bulldozers. So while we have the fuel to run bulldozers, we should be building swales in all of the even slightly hilly farmed areas so that we can continue using them to grow food after nitrogen fertilizer and other inputs run out.
I'm glad you brought that up. You know, one of my favorite books is by L.H. Bailey. Well, actually, it's a whole series called the Rural Science Series. They came out in the 1920s, before the days of chemical agriculture. And these books describe all the tricks of using wood stove ash, a manure, and some ground-up bones to make fertile soil instead of those fossil-based fertilizers, which are harmful to the environment and may not be available anyway. Do you see a return to some of that old knowledge?
Actually, I see some return to this old knowledge because, you know, it's not obsolete. It's still useful. But I also see rapid progress to new knowledge that didn't exist back then except in very few places, which is you can be much lazier than somebody who actually takes stuff and spreads it on the land because you can make ecosystems that do all the work for you. So, for instance, if you need certain soil amendments, then you plant certain trees that provide the mulch to make the soil the way it needs to be. People can provide stakes, for instance, when they plant certain trees, right, because it's windy. Well, an easier way is to provide a nanny tree, a fast-growing tree that you chop down once it's done, and that's just basically to create a microclimate so you don't have to use techniques, intensive, labor-intensive techniques like that. So there's a lot of stuff that people have come up with more recently than that, just by understanding biology and soil chemistry and things like that, to figure out how to use ecosystems instead of labor.
I really like those ideas. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dmitry Orlov. Orlov was born in the former Soviet Union and educated in the United States. He's the author of Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example and American Prospects, published in 2008. The book suggests the Soviets were better prepared for social and economic collapse than Americans are now. Dmitry, would you talk to us a little bit about your own experiments with, well, let's just say preparations?
Well, it's more experimentation than preparations. People who tell you that they're prepared are often a little bit wrong, you know, but still what they're doing is, you know, useful. And so what I'm trying to do is to do something useful. So a few years ago, back when, you know, real estate prices, housing prices were at a peak, I realized that the biggest expenses that we have and what really ties us down is the house and the car. Those are the biggest resource expenditures that any of us have, also the biggest energy expenditures. And so I sold our condominium and got rid of the car and bought a sailboat, a hand, you know, basically a custom-made, handmade, hand-built sailboat, not a production boat. And we moved aboard and spent 2 years, a little bit less, but cruising the entire eastern seaboard of the United States from Maine to Florida, living aboard in marinas and at anchor. We spent the entire last summer at anchor, completely off the grid. We only pulled up to the dock to take on water, and we only did that a handful of times. So it turns out that a sailboat is a remarkable test bed for testing all kinds of adaptive green technologies, because if you try to retrofit your house for these sorts of things, then basically you have to get building permits, and you have to get it has to be zoned for various uses. So if you can't just put up solar panels without seeking permission, or a big wind generator, for instance, is a no-no in a lot of communities. It has to be inspected. There has to be provisions in the code for doing this sort of thing, or you run into trouble. And then the whole property gets reappraised, so you get charged taxes for these things that are considered improvements. On a boat, you basically deal with American Boat and Yacht Council, which makes recommendations that are not really directly enforceable. And then you deal with the Coast Guard, which cares about certain safety provisions. But other than that, you're free to do anything. I mean, absolutely anything. You can craft anything you want, and provided it abides by just a few simple safety standards, you can very easily get away with it. So that's basically what I've been doing, and I built a lot of systems to make this sailboat into a survival pod, if you will. It's really quite self-sufficient at this point. I'm adding a few additional items, like a wood stove, for instance, but it's generally pretty far along in that direction. And everything that I've done to it, like composting toilet technology, for instance, first of all, it has to be built to a very high standard because it's on a sailboat. And anything that's on a boat gets stressed in ways that things that go into houses do not get stressed. And secondly, it has to be very compact. And thirdly, it has to be very maintainable because you're often away from anyone who could show up and service it for you. So the things that you get to work on a sailboat are virtually guaranteed to work in settled shoreside environment. And it's all very directly transferable. So I've accumulated quite a bit of knowledge of all sorts of useful things as a result.
You've also been in a running conversation with others trying to peer into this unstable future. I'm thinking of Sharon Astix and Rob Hopkins of Transition Towns and John Michael Greer. Is collapse becoming a movement, a sort of pioneers club?
I don't think collapse itself is becoming a pioneers club, but I think that you can basically see what the problems are, regardless of collapse, and you can start addressing those problems. And I think that that's what a lot of people are interested in right now, because if there is really collapse, then all of the things we're doing right now become virtually impossible. So it makes sense to do things regardless, provided that there is a risk of collapse. It's basically based on the precautionary principle. If there is a 10% chance of everything going to hell, then you work like hell to make sure that if it does happen, you don't particularly suffer. You know, that's why people buy insurance. So really, it's just an investment in the present. It's not even an investment in the future. It's to make the present as risk-free or low risk as possible.
Can you give us a bit of a progress report on how this collapse is developing?
Yes. The thing that has occurred over the past year or year and a half is we know what peak oil looks like when it happens. People think that it has to do with long lines at gas stations or with oil shortages or with sky-high oil prices. It turns out to look a little different. Basically, it looks like people running out of money and debts going bad and the economy not growing. Because the fact is that a lot of people can't really control their energy expenditure. They have to buy the gasoline to get where they're going. They find that they don't have the money to invest in a more energy-efficient car, for instance, or to make improvements to their houses to save on heating bills, because the money for that evaporates very early on in the process. And so they're basically stuck with high, relatively high, affordable, but high energy bills. What that happens is it reduces their expenditure in all the other areas. Bills go unpaid, their mortgage lapses, they don't maintain things as well as they should, and they spend less money. And so that causes a recession, causes more jobs to be lost, causes more people to have even less money. And that has a marginal effect on energy consumption, so energy prices moderate. So what we're going to have is moderately high energy prices, not enough investment going into the energy sector, which will basically cause little price spikes here and there when supply actually does fall below demand, but gently and gradually decreasing demand over time. And at the same time, we'll have rising unemployment and we'll have a lot of debts going bad and a lot of foreclosures and a lot of business bankruptcies. So that's basically what the plateau looks like. It was called a plateau a while ago, and there was a massive price spike, and now we have stubbornly high prices, and relatively high. And the whole thing seems to be stable, but very slowly unwinding. So more and more debts go bad. Before it was banks, now it's whole countries going bad, and there are no extraterrestrials that will come down and bail us out. So once big countries start going broke, then, you know, that's it for the financial collapse. That will have run its course. Now, overlapping with it is a commercial collapse where businesses can no longer function at the scale they're used to. You know, the canaries in the coal mine are the little mom-and-pop businesses, little hardware stores, things like that. A lot of them have closed. Small business is really suffering. Big box stores have more of a financial reserve. A lot of people consider them too big to fail. A lot of them get some kind of a bailout arrangement for the time being. But when those start failing, then that's probably the last thing for a lot of communities. A lot of communities, if you close the Walmart, then they have to drive very long distances in order to get what they need. So that will be pretty far along in the commercial collapse. Political collapse, it's just starting up. Now, there isn't really a lot of hope for the political process. I mean, if you look at, you know, the people participating in it, like Sarah Palin, for instance, not the sharpest knife in the drawer, or the guy who got elected in Massachusetts, where I am right now, God Brown, basically, a bunch of people in Western Mass, which is not where Boston is, thought that they could elect him to Congress so that their state taxes would go down. They don't really realize that Congress doesn't vote on state taxes. So that's the kind of brilliance that you can expect from the electorate. But they're very, very irate, and they will basically vote for all kinds of strange people, basically to punish their politicians for no other reason. And the question is, how long can that go on before it's clear that nothing useful can happen? What I've observed in Russia is a lot of talk and just general paralysis before the final political collapse occurred. But once it started, political collapse can be very sudden, can be very abrupt, because everybody gives up at the same time. And it's unclear when it'll happen, but there's a likelihood that it will.
I think a lot of people have given up or are in the process of doing it, and we certainly see paralysis in Washington these days. We're going to have to wrap it up at this point, Dimitri, but I wanted to give you a chance to tell us about your new limited edition book of essays that you've got going.
Well, first of all, I started working on the next book, the big next book, which is The Five Stages of Collapse, based on articles I've already written and talks I've given at conferences, and it's a very popular subject. People are very interested in this taxonomy of collapse, understanding how the various pieces interrelate in a collapse scenario. So I really want to be working on that book, but to raise funds for it, I decided to come up with a limited edition book of essays that basically my wife and I are not even so much selling. We're accepting donations, and then people who donate via my blog get this numbered, autographed, limited edition book of essays that we basically put in an envelope by hand, put stamps on the envelope, address the envelope, and send to them. And it's quite a bit of work because it's hundreds of copies. but we're just basically doing this extreme kind of organic self-publishing model, and it's working out remarkably well. It's a nice little book. It's very nicely designed, and I think people will really like it, and it gives them just something tangible to hold on to and share with other people. They're giving me a donation, and in return, I give them a gift.
Our guest has been Dmitry Orlov. Find his blog at cluborlov.blogspot.com, and his name is spelled O-R-L-O-V. I have ordered Dmitry's new collection of essays called Hold Your Applause, and Dmitry, I promise, if the power goes out, your essays will be the last book I burn to keep warm. Thanks so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock today.
Thank you.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Many people take their lead on collapse from the work of Joseph Tainter, the head of the Department of Environment and Society at the Utah State University. His book, The Collapse of Complex Societies, was published in 1988. Tainter looks at past civilizations, from the Maya to the Romans, to see why they went down. To quote from Wikipedia, Tainter argues that societies collapse when their investments in social complexity reach a point of diminishing marginal returns. He recognizes collapse when a society rapidly sheds a significant portion of its complexity, end quote. Let's hear a short clip from Joseph Tainter, found at archaeologychannel.org.
Modern society, doomsayers tell us, may be destroyed by pollution, overpopulation, global warming, energy shortages, or collision with an asteroid. Economists argue the opposite, that as long as we remain entrepreneurial, we can overcome all challenges. Most of us hope the economists are right, but wish we understood better why societies succeed or fail. Societies regularly face wars, catastrophes, changes in climate, and economic distress. We respond to problems today much as people did before, and from these commonalities we can learn about collapse, resiliency, and sustainability. An illuminating collapse was that of the Western Roman Empire in the 5th century AD. The Romans found conquest highly profitable at first, as they seized the accumulated wealth of the Mediterranean lands. But for a one-time infusion of wealth, Rome took on responsibilities to administer and defend the empire. These responsibilities lasted centuries and had to be paid from yearly agricultural production. When there were extraordinary expenses, usually during wars, the government often found itself short of money. The usual strategy was to stretch the silver currency by adding copper. This was inflationary, and by the middle of the 3rd century AD, the empire was bankrupt. The government would not even accept its own coins for payment of taxes. In the half-century from 235 to 284, the empire nearly came to an end. There were foreign and civil wars almost without interruption. Cities were sacked and provinces devastated. In the late 3rd and early 4th centuries AD, the emperors Diocletian and Constantine responded by designing a government that was larger, more complex, more highly organized, and much more costly. They doubled the size of the army at great expense. To pay for this, peasants were taxed so heavily that they abandoned lands and could not replenish the population. From the late 4th century, the barbarians forced their way into the Western Empire. They overthrew the last emperor in Italy in 476 AD. I call this the Roman model of problem solving. The Romans responded to challenges by increasing the size and complexity of their government and army at great expense. Fiscal weakness and exploitation of the population undermined the effort and made collapse inevitable. The Eastern Roman Empire survived the 5th century crisis. We know it today as the Byzantine Empire. It was constantly at war, and in the early 7th century, a 26-year war with Persia left both sides exhausted. Arab armies seized the wealthiest parts of the Byzantine realm and destroyed the Persian Empire entirely. Soon the Arabs were attacking Constantinople itself, the Byzantine capital. Yet the Byzantines made a remarkable recovery. They settled their professional army on farmlands across the empire. Soldiers now provided most of their own sustenance, and the government paid them a much lower salary. Byzantine government and society simplified also. Cities contracted to fortified hilltops. The economy became organized around self-sufficient manors. Literacy declined. The simplification rejuvenated Byzantium, which not only halted the Arab advance, but eventually doubled the size of the empire. Unlike the Romans, who met challenges by increasing complexity and costliness, the Byzantines show us what may be history's only example of a large, complex society systematically simplifying. I label this the Byzantine model.
When Radio EcoShock continues, we'll go further with Archdruid John Michael Greer. Stay tuned while you still can.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Our next guest is a knife that cuts listeners into parts in a way, those who know and love his work, those who might doubt his vision or expertise, and some who don't yet know him. John Michael Greer is more of a mystic than a scientist, you could say. He has a degree in the comparative history of ideas. He's published at least 18 books, now he tells me 20, and most of them were on magic and the occult. But we've called him today about two very different books, The Long Descent, A User's Guide to the End of the Industrial Age, published in 2008, and The Ecotechnic Future, Envisioning a Post-Peak World, out just last fall. John Michael, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
Well, I've looked forward to talking with you, and it's strange because you and I approach some of the same problems with very different belief systems and come up with similar conclusions. Isn't life a strange place that way?
Very much so.
Well, as I was preparing to talk with you, I happened to read an article in the Canadian paper, The Globe and Mail, on February 14th, and it was titled, An Inevitable Collapse, At Least It's Not a Crash. And I immediately thought of a long-running debate in your work, years ahead of the time, I must say. Can you tell us how a long descent differs from the crash that everyone seems worried about?
Well, the crucial thing, I think, to understand is that our conceptions of our future are typically based on a set of narratives that most of us have not examined too closely. I mean, a lot of us have, I think probably all of us have stuck in our heads the notion of a sort of overnight Hollywood collapse where everything comes crashing down in flames, and of course there's a small band of plucky survivors, who end up becoming the leads in the movie, whatever it is. It's amazing how often that kind of thing dominates thinking about the future. Everybody wants to come up with the thing that is going to cause the collapse, and then, you know, they'll be among the plucky survivors who get the second-level billing and maybe a shot at an Oscar. In the real world, that's not how civilizations end. In the real world, civilizations wind down in a slow, ragged process of breakdown extending typically from 1 to 3 centuries. And which involves periods of contraction and crisis, interspersed with periods of even partial recovery, stabilization. It's a complex thing. Rome wasn't sacked in a day, if you want to put it that way. And one of the things that really motivated my book, The Long Descent, was and a number of other projects related to it, is an attempt to get across to people, look, we need to be aware of the difference between Hollywood and history, between the future that we may like to imagine and the future that we're likely to encounter.
Why would you presume that we won't find a way out, though, like a technical fix or a new energy source?
Okay. First of all, why would one presume that we will? Every civilization, other than ours, basically, every civilization has been through this kind of thing, in some cases many times. Go to China, you know, you look at the cycle of Chinese dynasties, there's, you know, a period of success and then a long period of collapse and contraction, and then another, they rise up and do it again. They've been through it like 5 times so far. This is part of the normal rhythm of civilization. And it seems, first of all, rather perhaps arrogant and, to my mind, even silly to think that we are somehow exempt from this cycle. Secondly, though, all of the signs that have been in the past indicating that other civilizations have been heading toward history's dumpster are present and accounted for in the present situation. We have overshot our ecological limits. We are rapidly drawing down the non-renewable resources on which our society depends. There's a lot of talk about how we're going to come up with some marvelous new thing, but that same talk has been in circulation since the 1950s, and the marvelous new things are nowhere to be seen. sooner or later we actually have to buckle down to the possibility that, in fact, the probability that Santa Claus is not going to leave a bright new energy source under our Christmas trees in time. And I know this is another thing that's that flies in the face of our Hollywood narratives, but I suggest that at this point it's the most likely future we face.
And this long descent, it seems like such a change from your previous work. What brought you to write it?
Well, the interesting thing is that this is something that I've been interested in about as long as I've been interested in the esoteric spirituality that was my original major writing theme. It still is something I write about quite a bit. I got involved in esoteric spirituality. I got involved in the whole appropriate tech and alternative energy and futures movements, both in the 1970s. And with the coming of the Reagan era in the 1980s, you know, America's back. We don't have to worry about energy shortages anymore. The free market will conjure energy out of thin air. There were very few of us who maintained an interest in appropriate tech and things like that. I was one. But there was no market for that. Nobody was interested in hearing about it. So I mostly concentrated in developing my writing career and pursuing my studies, the other side of things. But I retained my interest the whole time in, okay, what are we going to do as the oil starts running short? When when peak oil first started creeping back into the news right around the turn of the millennium, I started writing some essays for the Druid community at that point and saying, you know, this is something that may well shape our future. We need to start thinking about how our religious community, our spiritual community, is going to respond to this potentially very awkward future ahead of us. And quite unexpectedly, those essays and the blog that I ended up writing about the subject went from being a very small phenomenon in the Druid scene to a fairly widely read phenomenon in peak oil circles and future-oriented circles around the world, translated into several languages, this kind of stuff. So the books came out of that.
And as we know, the Internet enables some kindred thinkers to carry on working on current problems. And recently you called for the development of intentional communities to survive the coming collapse. And in a flash, bloggers like Sharon Astick and Rob Hopkins and Dmitry Orlov, they kicked in their take. What are your ideas on intentional communities?
That's a complicated question because that's certainly one approach, and it's certainly an approach that's worth exploring. But it's crucial to remember that a community is an organic thing. It's trying to make a community is a real challenge. It's a little like trying to manufacture a tree. And it's a community is something that has to grow. It's something that has to take shape according to its own dynamics. And a lot of the attempts to create intentional communities, as we saw in the wake of the 60s and more recently, a lot of those crash and burn because they run into the gap between what people's intentions are and how things actually work in the real world. I think it's still something very much exploring, but there are also other things like paying attention to the communities in which we already actually live that deserve a fair amount of attention.
Yeah, because I've got some experience in this myself. Back in the 80s, seven of us bought a 200-acre rundown farm, and we lived there for 10 years without electricity. It was wonderful. I got in touch with nature, but it was tough going.
Oh,
and,
it is.
You know, I'm doubtful many people could handle those changes. But maybe there won't be an alternative if governments and the economy start failing even more badly than they are now.
I would find it amazing if governments were to fail more badly than they're doing now. I mean, at this point, since really about 1980, every major government in the world, certainly that I can think of, has been devotedly making all the wrong choices. You'd think they were following a script. It's amazing.
Well, my general rule of thumb is if George Bush was for it, it's wrong.
Unfortunately, the same could be said of Clinton or Obama, or you know, or I'm sure there are equivalents in Canadian politics or anywhere. It's rather ironic that George W. Bush, with all of the hideous decisions and hideous mistakes that were made during his regime, his ranch in Crawford, Texas, is very green. He's got solar panels. He's got all that kind of stuff.
Amazing. Well, you also talk about the personal mobility made possible by cheap oil and how that has affected our inner identity. Do you want to talk about that for a minute?
Well, yeah. The thing is, we've been able to pretend that we're isolated individuals who don't need any kind of a root in the world, any kind of root in community, in place, because we can always just pick up and climb into our cars and go someplace else. That's been something that was made possible by the fact that we have so much energy sloshing about. As that winds down, that's going to be much less the case, and we're going to have to look at some serious changes in how we conceive of ourselves, thinking of, you know, the kind of me-first attitude that is, that has pervaded industrial cultures for the last century, really, is going to have to give way again to a realization that the basic unit of human survival is the community. And if you're not willing to be there for your neighbors, they are not going to be there for you, and that may not be a recipe for a very long life.
And no Greer interview could be complete without a question on catabolic collapse. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's kind of the formal title of the model of decline and fall that I referred to earlier, the sort of slow, ragged decline that happens when a society is trying to survive against odds that it can't beat. It's catabolic. Catabolism is the process by which a body or anything else uses up its own reserves. And a catabolic collapse is a process of social contraction in which a society fighting for survival ends up burning through its own legacy. It uses its buildings for recycled, for raw materials. It scraps things. It burns things. Everything goes to short-term survival. And in the process, it makes its own long-term survival impossible. We're already well into that process now. My favorite current example of that are the number of libraries. They're basically scrapping every old book they've got. In some cases, there are college libraries that are scrapping all of their books. They're going for totally electronic resources, which means nothing from before about the 1990s. And so all of the heritage, all of the history, all of the ways of doing things that don't presuppose vast amounts of cheap energy are going away. Because it's a cost-cutting measure, because it's a way of saving energy, saving money, saving resources right now that are going to cause massive problems further down the road.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking with the mystic and social critic John Michael Greer. Usually EcoShock is a science-based show, but we humans do have an inner world of dreams and beliefs beyond science. John Michael, how did your spiritual journey take you towards environmentalism?
Well, as a druid, nature is holy. That's probably the basic summary of modern druid spirituality. I should stress, first of all, that modern druids do not claim to be descended from the ancient Celtic druids. It would be nice, but the evidence simply isn't there. As far as we can tell, the modern druid community came into existence in the early 18th century as a response, and in some way, the rejection of the Industrial Revolution. A lot of people saw what was going on, saw humanity turning its back on nature, and said, hold it, there's got to be a better way. It is not a large spiritual community, but it's kind of a colorful one. But at any rate, when you start from the assumption that, or you start from the basic presupposition that nature is sacred, that nature is the basic frame in which we live, from which we draw meaning, from which we draw our happiness, in which everything we do and everything we are is based, that puts you in a system of priorities where, goosing the gross national product another 2% by ravaging forests and dumping toxic chemicals into people's drinking water suddenly doesn't make a lot of sense anymore. And so you get a lot of what I suppose you'd have to call ecological attitudes out of that. One thing that the Druid movement, the Druid community, also very much tries to foster is a knowledge of the scientific dimension of nature. You get a lot of people in the Druid scene who have at least the basics of scientific ecology down cold. You get a lot of people who read very carefully in the natural sciences and things like that, and that's something that I rather enjoy doing also. And so it's very much part of the same picture of just an orientation towards something that is larger and deeper than the quarterly profits of the human economy, and something that relates to the natural world on which we depend moment by moment for our survival.
Have you seen the movie Avatar?
I haven't yet.
I think you might like it.
I've been told that by a number of people. I'm not a great movie fan as it goes, and of course I read several of the novels on which it was pretty transparently based. Ursula Le Guin's The Word for World is Forest comes to mind, for example. There are not a lot of movie theaters in the small town where I live, but when Avatar wanders over, I may make some time for it.
We face the frightening possibilities of peak oil or social unrest, a climate shift, or even an extinction event. Do you see a coming new religion or more spirituality as people try to deal with the confusion and fear?
Well, that's almost inevitable whenever a civilization goes into decline. When a civilization is expanding, when you've got plenty of energy, plenty of wealth, all kinds of abundance sloshing around, people can afford to, or think they can afford to, avoid the inner side of their own lives. But it's when societies start contracting that, the rubber really hits the road, and it becomes very clear that you can have all the stuff you want, and it doesn't actually make that big of a difference in your life. I forget who it was that pointed out that salvation is perhaps the one actually infinitely renewable resource. But a lot of historical writers who've studied the decline of civilizations have pointed out that periods of decline are the great seedbeds of religious movements, just as Christianity really took off during the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. Buddhism was fostered very powerfully by the declines of empires in India and China, and so on. You can find many examples.
I'm worried that masses of undereducated people with their minds dumbed down by celebrity news will fall into a mysticism they don't understand instead of dealing with science and harsh reality. Isn't that a problem? And if so, are you part of that?
Well, they could equally, being just as dumbed down, fall into a science they don't understand. There is a religion of science. I figure any belief system that claims to know where the world came from and what happens when we die is a religion. And you get plenty of people of Richard Dawkins variety and so on who claim to have all the answers. And they do it on the basis of science, and what they're promoting is, to my mind, a particularly bleak and boring religion. What I would point out, though, is that very often in history, perhaps not at the moment, but very often in history, science has been fostered by religious movements. It was as a result of Christian monks, for example, that we know most of what we know about Greek and Roman science. It was as a result of Muslim scholars, devout Muslim scholars in what we call the Dark Ages, and were actually the great ages of Arabic civilization, that huge amounts of other knowledge from the ancient world got through. Some very important scientific discoveries were made by these people. The same is true elsewhere in the world. I mean, Mayan astronomy, a calendar more accurate than the one we use today, was created by Mayan priests who were using it to predict the future by astrology. So this notion that science and religion are necessarily opposed to one another, and that science has some kind of accepting these hard scientific realities is a hope for salvation for our culture, where religion is this trap that we can fall into. It makes great propaganda, but it doesn't actually reflect what happens in the world, and I'm not really sure that it's a useful way of looking at things now.
All right, well, let's get back to peak oil a bit. And incidentally, I like what you just said, but I want to assume that energy gets more and more expensive, not just oil, but electricity too, and all that stuff hauled around the world becomes harder and possible to get. What should our listeners do to prepare for that?
Okay, the first thing that needs to be done is you need to take a hard look at the difference between what you need and what you want. Right now, in the industrial world, most of us have a list of needs, quote-unquote, which are actually simply wants. We can get by on much less than we have, and we need to learn how to do that. Partly that involves reinventing the household economy that most people used to derive a lot of their goods and services from. I mean, back not that long ago, of your average married couple, one member stayed home, one member went out to work. The person who stayed home was not sitting on her hind end, taking in soap operas. She was working, she was producing value, she was generating a lot of goods and services, a lot of real wealth outside the cash economy. At a time when the cash economy is going to bits because of severe financial mismanagement on the parts of governments, we need to start looking again at the reinvention of a household economy. That does not mean that it should necessarily be set up by gender as it was 50 or 100 years ago. It does mean we need to start looking at what we can do for ourselves, what we can do in our own communities, in our own homes, in our own backyards, because that's the stuff that economic fluctuations can't take away from us. We also need to look at what Rob Hopkins calls the great reskilling. Most of us don't know how to do anything useful. I mean, we're great at sitting at a desk with a keyboard or something doing stuff that doesn't actually produce anything of value. But people need to be in a position to produce things of value again for themselves and their friends and their communities. We need people who can brew good beer, for heaven's sakes. You know, when it's no longer being shipped in semis, well, not that you get a lot of good beer that way anyway. There's a lot of things we need to be able to make and do for ourselves. We don't have to do it all for ourselves individually, but we need to be able to contribute to the reemergence of a community network of exchange that will produce a growing fraction of the goods and services we all need to get by. So those are some starter points. I mean, there's a lot more of where that came from, basically.
Well, yes, in your books, I would say. And before I forget, can you give listeners the address of your blog?
Okay, the blog is titled The Archdruid Report, and it's http://thearchdruidreport.blogspot.com.
Good enough. And, you know, I'd like to pass the microphone over to you now. What would you like to talk about?
That's always a challenging question when somebody asks me at an interview. I would say the thing that I would like to talk about is the need to be aware that there is a middle ground between utopian fantasies, the perfect future that we want delivered to our doorstep, and horror tales of the ghastly future that we all, you know, want to think about quietly at night when we don't think we'll actually have to undergo it. Real history, real futures, real human social change happens day by day. It's not heaven and it's not hell. It is, you know, real life. And the world that we're facing it's going to have huge challenges. It's going to involve a lot of impoverishment of all of us in real terms. We are all going to have much less stuff. There will be a lot more challenges. There are going to be things that we can do and get and be now that will no longer be a possibility. That doesn't mean, you know, huddling in a cabin on the mountainside or blazing away at zombie hordes with automatic weapons or some silliness like that. We're facing a real future, not a Hollywood future. And I think if people can take the time to get their heads around that in itself will be a major step toward planning for the very challenging but potentially rewarding future that is actually ahead of us.
Can you tell us a little bit about your new book, The Ecotechnic Future?
Yeah, that was kind of the things I had wanted to say in The Long Descent and didn't realize it until the book was finished. The Long Descent was just talking about the basic process by which civilizations decline and fall, how we're following that, what we can expect, just sort of a run through there. The Ecotechnic Future, I got to work as that project wound down with, okay, what does this say about history? What does this say about who we are, about what we can expect in the future? What kind of world are we making by our choices right now? What can we do to change that? And so the Ecotechnic Future is an attempt on a broader level to say, what kind of world are we moving into in this process of decline? What kind of changes can we expect, with some reference to things like climate, ecological change, social change? What does a dark age look like? Because, you know, that's what we're talking about, the decline and fall of an empire and the coming of a dark age. And so it was described by the blurb writer as harrowing but ultimately hopeful, and I suppose that's not a bad description. It's also an attempt to talk about how we think about history and how we delude ourselves about the present and about the future, and kind of what that says about where we're headed and why and how. So it's a little bit more of a philosophical book. It is an attempt to set The Long Descent in its wider context.
Of course, if we pull ourselves out of a less meaningful and sort of plastic identity and discover new things about ourselves and our relations and our community, it might seem more like a light age than a dark age.
Well, that's true, except just be aware that for most of us it's going to be these marvelous discoveries are going to be made while standing knee-deep in mud hoeing a field.
Okay.
You know, six days a week. It is important to remember that there are positive possibilities, but it's important not to get caught up in the sort of fantasy of, you know, carrying on a comfortable middle-class lifestyle in an age where that has gone away forever.
Our guest has been John Michael Greer, Grand Archdruid in America and author of two books on making the transition from the fossil age to a very different world. Check out The Long Descent, A User's Guide to the End of the Industrial Age, and The Ecotechnic Future, Envisioning a Post-Peak World, both from New Society Publishers. John Michael, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. I've enjoyed it.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Our background music is Open Up Your Eyes by Awake. The band dedicated another song, Industrial Cemeteries, to John Michael Greer. The album is Dark Matter.
In the books of the dead that created life for his craft and tell of creatures to scavenge within the night. Listen to every word that seems sublimely absurd, but you'll finally understand of what they
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
In 2005, John Michael Greer published a scholarly paper titled How Civilizations Fall, A Theory of Catabolic Collapse. Find a link to that in my Radio EcoShock blog dated March 4th, 2010. Just go to ecoshock.org and click on blog. Greer finds Tainter's explanations lack some positive feedback loops. Those self-reinforcing drivers of decline emerging from things like limited resources and our failing biosphere. In the later stages of a civilization, most of the capital is converted into waste. Can anyone spell junk bonds or credit default swaps? There certainly has been a downturn in media expectations. After the year of green shoots and the drumbeats of recovery, there are a slew of experts gently warning we're still in the crapper. You may feel a little pain. From the OECD economists to JP Morgan, capital experts see another slide coming. Investigations into Goldman Sachs padding the books for entire nations like Greece and Italy and more are leaking out the awful truth. We fixed nothing in the banking system or our economy, and we faked our way through another year. Recalling the models from history as presented by Joseph Tainter, we find that collapse isn't all bad for everyone. For those toiling under the yoke of impossible imperialism, it is a relief when the war economy ends. For those eating industrial agro-garbage, real food grown tastes good and sweet. The cynicism of our present failures morph into new beliefs as the old is cleaned away. The wild Germans and Celts longed for the fall of Rome, though they kept using some of their technologies and symbols. In Byzantium, simplification and self-sufficiency led to centuries more civilization. I'm also reminded of Roberto Vacca's 1973 book, The Coming Dark Age. As a computer architect, Vacca predicted modern complexity would overreach and fall apart. The dreaded system breakdown. It didn't happen then. A version of that book, updated by the author in the year 2000, is now free on the net. Find a link in my blog. Back in the 70s, Vacca couldn't foresee just how much computers would help humans organize beyond their individual capabilities. Once we survived the urge for atomic self-annihilation, we got another 30 years out of computer-assisted living. Until Windows and the mega servers hit the virus they just can't swallow, or the power goes out in a megastorm. Richard Heinberg warns most of our ready-to-click knowledge could disappear in a day without the machines. Meanwhile, you can feed your worries with the new article coming out this week in the March-April issue of Foreign Affairs. The Harvard historian Niall Ferguson calls it Complexity and Collapse, Empires on the Edge of Chaos. See what I mean? Everybody's onto it. We don't know where collapse is taking us or when, only that it's coming. Get more in next week's Radio EcoShock ongoing coverage. As Niall Ferguson writes, we may not have time to figure out the theory if collapse comes quickly and without warning. I'm Alex Smith. Find more free audio at our website, ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening.
Scene, but the creating a scene is not illegal. You are born free, you will live free, you will die free. You are allowed to make a scene, you're allowed to scream for joy, you're allowed to complain, you're allowed to cry, you're allowed to love people, you're allowed to hug people.
and we're starting to live in a world where we're starting to feel scared. We're starting to forget just how divine and special we are as human beings. Every single one of you is the only example of you that will ever exist. And there's not a single authority on this world, especially not private security men, who can tell you how to behave in any time, any place, anywhere. You are free, you will live free, you will die free. The only chains that exist are in your mind. You can do anything you want if you put your mind to it.